From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made sometime in the future, and perhaps as soon as 2020. Our society is going to have to turn away from carbon eventually because, well, we'll have to. Finite resources are finite for a reason. And so what's next? Cellulosic ethanol? Some other form of alternative energy? How about solar? When will we finally be able to see solar at the scale that will allow us to use most of our power from solar energy? It might not be that far away, and my guest for the hour is someone who can talk at length on that subject and more. Susan Spencer's in studio, and her story of how she has become a climate change communicator, an alternative energy communicator, is a fascinating one. We're thrilled to have her in studio for the hour. Susan, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
By the way, before we even get to your story, 2020, we're not that far. We're only 6 years from 2020.
6 years away, that's correct.
But we're not, that's not hyperbole to talk about the possibility of a solar future.
No, we're predicting that 82% of the world's population will be living in an area that in 2020 will have the cost of energy from solar equal to or less than the cost from traditional grid electricity.
Before we get there, I want to tell your personal story because I think this is such an interesting one of how many things have happened so quickly. Susan is from Rochester, went to West Irondequoit High School, then to MCC with a degree in biotechnology, then to RIT in chemistry. You're finishing your PhD in microsystems engineering?
That's correct.
What is microsystems engineering?
Microsystems engineering is a very diverse field, but all of us focus on understanding systems at a microscopic or nanoscopic level to make them better and more efficient and more applicable for society.
You are looking at quantum photophysics of organic solar cells. I can read that. I can't quite communicate what that means.
So what I do is examine how light interacts with the molecules that I design for my solar cells, and I then explain why the molecular structure is either good or not good for the purpose of making a highly efficient solar cell.
You're also now communicating some of these things to the public more broadly. Apart from this program, August 1st at 6 p.m., you're going to be at the Xerox Auditorium at RIT doing what?
I will be giving a presentation on climate change that I learned how to give at my training in Australia, and I will be discussing global warming, climate change, the impacts, and the solutions.
You're also going to be giving a TEDx Rochester talk on November 15th on the same subject?
The TEDx talk is going to be focused more narrowly on the future of solar power in Rochester for the next 5 to 10 years and how we can take advantage of what we have available to us.
All right. So Susan is someone who's been studying and preparing to work in a world that will require a shift in energy resources. But some of the last few weeks of your life have been a whirlwind. So let's go back to I think it was actually the end of April. On this program, Neil deGrasse Tyson was a guest in advance of his visit to MCC at the end of April. He spoke at MCC, huge crowd. Obviously, it was an overflow crowd there. And then at the end of his presentation, he took some questions. Now, I know you were in the audience.
Yes, I was.
What happened?
Well, he's my favorite astrophysicist, so I lined up to ask him a question about writer's block, actually. As I'm preparing my PhD thesis, it can be challenging sometimes. So I asked Mr. Tyson how to become a better science communicator and what I could do to communicate the science that I do to everyone that I know, not just my peer group of scientists and engineers. He gave me some great recommendations, but one of them was to go on Twitter and follow the top 5 people that were doing what I wanted to be doing. So I followed Mr. Gore and his foundation, the Climate Reality Project.
You followed Al Gore's foundation?
Yep.
On Neil deGrasse Tyson's advice?
Correct.
And then shortly thereafter, what happens?
The foundation tweeted out a link to apply to be trained as a climate reality leader with Mr. Gore. And I saw the tweet and decided to fill out the application. It was a 20-page online application full of really interesting short answer question and responses. And 2 weeks later, I was notified that I'd been accepted.
So that was in May?
Yes.
So you're accepted, and it was in June. You ended up going to Melbourne, Australia, for the foundation's training from June 23rd through the 27th. About 500 people from around the world there for the training. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And the themes, apart from being able to more effectively communicate on these issues, which is an important theme in and of itself, the true cost of carbon. Tell me about the theme and how it was developed in that conference.
Well, it was very important for us to understand exactly what we are going to be up against in a way. So fossil fuels have an enormous cost that isn't really reflected in prices at the pump or prices of our energy. And what we learned was the true cost of fossil fuels on the environment, on human health, on our infrastructure. So that was developed over the 4 days, with the culmination being Mr. Gore presenting the talk to us and then describing it for about 8 hours straight.
8 hours straight of Al Gore. I knew he could talk.
He was a very eloquent, passionate, excited person to listen to. So it was very nice. It was a very good talk.
How much of those 5 days for you did you feel were simply being able to come away from there better able to communicate?
I think that was a very large component of those 5 days. It was an enormously diverse group. So there were scientists and engineers like myself, but there were also students and teachers and, high school students and musicians and artists and activists. And we all received the same training and learned how to be able to discuss both the challenges and the realities of global warming, as well as what we can do to mitigate the effects and move forward for a better future.
We're not going to bog down in the politics here, but I have heard some very impressive and intelligent folks. I think of Guy Harrison, who's written about the value of skepticism, who's been on the show. He writes that climate change is so important, and he thinks Al Gore is not a great messenger because instantly half your audience doesn't want to listen. And I know you felt inspired by him, but are you worried that that has sort of put politics into something that should not have been political?
I think that politics were going to be involved in it no matter what happened, because the way that the U.S. system works, politics are kind of inherent when we're talking about major policy changes. So I would hope that anyone listening who doesn't like Al Gore is at least willing to listen to me as an apolitical, non-biased messenger about climate change.
Someone from the science community.
Right. Okay. That's correct.
If you want to join the conversation, we invite you to do that. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994 right here in Rochester. My guest for the hour is Susan Spencer, a scientist and an engineer who is completing a PhD in the subject of microsystems engineering and who's going to be giving presentations on climate change and the future of solar in Rochester and, frankly, around the world as we figure out how to make certain things scalable. So we're going to be diving more into that, but let's grab our first call. This is Keith. Thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Keith.
Have an interesting show, and nobody's even asked the question. I got a question to ask your guest. More of a comment, too. Why is it nobody, there's not a large push, other than I believe Germany is doing it, in taking out excess electricity? For example, if you have windmills or solar cells that are creating electricity, but sometimes makes more than you need, or it makes it when you can't use it, such as in the nighttime with wind generating. Just take that electricity, run it through water, distill the water into hydrogen and oxygen, then off the oxygen, save the hydrogen, and then when you need extra energy, burn the hydrogen, which is 100% pollution free, and you're just creating water again. To me, that seems like a no-brainer solution. But nobody seems to be pushing it other than on a smaller scale in Germany.
It's a great question, Keith, and that's a good entry point into our conversation on solar power itself. So let's start, Susan, by responding to some of the points that Keith raised there.
Sure, Keith, that's a great question. Comment. Where we are right now in the States is a different place than where Germany is. I think Germany
is Germany the world leader in this?
They are currently the world leader in usage of solar power. So they just got, I believe, 2014, they're at 31% of their overall power is from renewable energies. China is the world leader in actual PV module production. So to kind of give you an idea of the big players. Here in the States, we are slowly but surely coming on board. And I think the technology that you spoke of specifically, Keith, there's lots of technologies like that that are being brought on board and beginning to be incorporated in order to make our transition to renewable energies as efficient as we possibly can. So I think that as the technology grows and as it becomes more utilized and more predominant, we're going to see a lot of new ideas and new ways to keep our power that we're making as efficient as possible.
Okay, and let's build off of Keith's questions there. And I know you saw before the hour even began, we had a question on Twitter that came in. And look, I think this is a common question people have when it comes to solar power and energy regarding just relying on sunlight itself. And that question came, I'm scrolling through here to find, from... it comes from Josh. And Josh says, I believe we need something called sunlight for solar power. It's always cloudy. Well, let's start there, Susan.
Sure. So, yes, we do need sunlight in order for solar power to work. Completely agree with you there, Josh. The great thing about our solar cell technology is that it has evolved. So we no longer need to only capture visible light. We're also now able to capture UV light and near-infrared. So even on a day that is cloudy, our solar cells are still going to be able to collect photons and generate electricity from them.
What's the difference between a cloudy day and a sunny day in terms of just how much more energy you can get?
Well, that's a difficult question to give an exact answer to because mm-hmm. it will depend on the solar cell technology. One of the most advantageous things about new technology is that it is working quite well under low light conditions, with some technologies able to directly compete with those that would be relying on sunlight like you would find in Arizona.
When we had the Sierra Club on a couple months ago, that we talked about some of the challenges of transitioning an economy away from carbon. And you had a UN report looking at the possible cost of transitioning and reducing carbon by 40 to 70% by the year 2050. You have people like George Will and Charles Krauthammer warning all the time that if we make that transition, we will gut our own economy. So the question becomes, do we have a scalable alternative? Germany, you said, is doing it at a more scalable level. What needs to start happening? Give me a sense for the timeline for making solar scalable here, Susan, to make it really compete and replace carbon?
Well, I think we're already on the uptick. We're already heading there right now. And the reason for that is a fourfold reason. So the cost of the technology is dropping significantly. As we make more modules, the cost to make them becomes less. Additionally, the quality and the efficiency of the solar modules is improving dramatically. So that's kind of the area that I work in more specifically with my R&D is helping to make these efficiency improvements, which in turn is going to bring down the cost. The next point is that solar power can be an individual consumer's choice. So it doesn't have to be a complete reworking of the entire grid. An individual person is able to put solar on their house and begin reaping rewards from it. So a similar technological advancement happened in Africa with cell phone use. So it was predicted that you're going to need landlines, and it's going to be very expensive, and it's going to be very difficult, and it's just not going to happen. And then a new technology, cell phones, came in and completely disrupted that market. So this type of technological advancement at an incredibly quick pace has happened before. And this is what we think is going to be happening with solar.
And almost immediately, we've got Javi asking about putting solar on the house. How do you actually do it? So, okay, that's a good question. You talked about an individual consumer's choice. Javi is asking, as an individual consumer, I'm interested if it makes sense. But do you go to Home Depot and grab solar stuff? I mean, give me a sense for how you start doing it, Susan.
So, as I stated, I'm in R&D and I don't do the installations myself.
Sure, right.
But what you can do is you can actually work through Monroe County to find out the tax credits, subsidies, and grants that are available.
And if you're not in Monroe County, I'm sure there are other agencies,
yes,
et cetera.
Yep.
We go all the way to Ithaca here, Susan.
Oh, good heavens.
We're not so Rochester-centric all the time, but go ahead.
Even in Tompkins County, then, I'm assuming they also have a website.
There you go.
And you can go there and you can find out about the helpful financial aspect. And then within there, there are lists of companies that are actually able to do the installation. So my personal recommendation is that you use a local company and they will take care of the installation for you. They'll take care of the purchasing of the solar panels for you. If something goes wrong, you have some trusted experts that you can go to, you know, to deal with anything that may happen. And that's actually something that I'm going to be covering quite extensively at the TEDx talk. So I'll be giving a breakdown there of Rochester Solar and how and who we should be turning to. But I'm happy to help Javi more so if he needs it.
Can you give us at least some ideas? I mean, it's not quite November yet, so but who we ought to turn to? I think a lot of us would like to see alternative energies become more competitive. Competition can drive costs down and help spur more development. Who are we turning to right now?
Well, there's a couple of companies in Rochester that I'm not going to mention by name on air because I haven't spoken with them about doing that ahead of time. But there's the biggest thing is actually being able to make solar cells here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's wonderful installation companies. It's just like getting your windows installed, right? Great companies. The biggest thing is being able to buy USA panels. And the reason why I say that is that that's going to bring the biggest impact to USA's carbon footprint and towards changing the way that businesses are viewing this technology. So in my opinion, that's the direction that we need to be pushing in is encouraging and promoting the people that are actually trying to make these renewable technologies here in the U.S., in New York, in Rochester.
When it comes to the installation, we're talking about homeowners and consumers, but we're going to see, and I would assume your future that you envision here includes businesses doing the same,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yep. I mean, we've got, so Harbeck Plastics has wind power, and they're working to become a completely carbon neutral, water neutral facility. And the reason for this, while it is also something that feels good and is good for the environment, it's economically beneficial for these businesses. So,
that's what's going to change the conversation. If they understand it and if they believe it and if it's true.
And that is one of my goals, is to help businesses understand that this is a smart economic choice. So if you think about this, what you're doing when you switch to solar is you're making an investment in a technology, and it's going to be a somewhat high initial investment for a business. They're going to need a fairly large amount of solar panels. But once the investment has been made, the solar power begins to pay for itself. And the sun is an absolutely unlimited resource that we can tap into. And the savings are going to allow these businesses to spend more money on hiring or on advertisement or on healthcare for their employees or whatever their current business needs are. If we can take away some of the money that they have to spend on energy, it will only help business and industry grow here in Rochester.
We saw about 10 years ago a big push, especially by government, toward corn-based ethanol. And, well, Susan actually just recoiled a little bit there. Did you recoil a little bit?
It was more of a chuckle because, yes.
Involuntary recoil.
Yeah.
So to some degree, there is a bad taste in people's mouth about picking winners and losers of our alternative energy future, because the one that we picked last time was such a dud, corn-based ethanol, for a number of reasons. Is there any reason that you see, as a scientist and engineer working in this field, mm-hmm, that will say we could possibly look back at solar and say, here's what we didn't foresee unintended consequences, other costs, and it was a mistake?
No, I don't believe that we will say that. And that may sound like I have an enormous amount of hubris in saying that, but I'm basing this on some years of experience and a lot of peer-reviewed journals. Where we currently are is getting the technology as good as it possibly can be. In terms of utilizing that technology and installing it, we can only go upward. We can really only move forward. And look, solar does not have the potential to create something like the BP spill or to create something like Three Mile Island. Solar power is inherently a safe technology made with well-known, well-characterized, safe materials. And there's not really a big potential for us to look back and have regrets unless we don't act. I think that's where the regrets would come from.
My guest for the hour is Susan Spencer, who is talking about the future of solar technology, solar energy sources, and the adaptation that our society is making as we get a better handle on our climate. And Susan is going to be giving a presentation on August 1st at 6 p.m. at the Xerox Auditorium at RIT. She's also going to be giving a TEDx talk in Rochester on November 15th. So a couple of opportunities to see her share more of her insight, whether it's about solar or about climate change and other mechanisms that as we sort of grapple with it. Let's get back to the phones. This is Bob in Mendon. Bob, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Hi, Susan. We have a pole barn with a lot of roof surface that we were thinking about doing solar. But listening to you talk, it's the same question we always have, and that's, with the race of technology constantly advancing and the cells getting better and better and the prices keep dropping as a result, when is the best time to get into the market? I mean, is it better to wait until the prices are low enough and the technology is advanced enough? Or, you know, when do we pull the trigger on?
What a great question. And I was actually just thinking, Bob, I feel the same way about getting a cell phone. Do I wait 6 months and the new iPhone's out, or do I just spend the money now and feel like I've got an outdated technology? It's a great question.
Exactly.
What do you think, Susan?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Bob. The answer that I will give you will hopefully be satisfactory. So the current PV modules that are available are silicon-based PV modules. And those modules they have dropped very significantly in price over the last 10, 20 years. And purchasing them now is going to be a solid investment. The cost will continue to go down, but it has already dropped quite significantly. In terms of new technologies that are advancing, there's always going to be new stuff, new phones, new solar on the market. If it were able to compete with silicon at the price point that silicon has, it would already be available. So I would say that while you will see prices continue to coming down, there's no better time to get into the PV installation than now because of how significantly they have dropped.
That help, Bob?
It does, and I'm wondering if there's a huge advancement, let's say, are the panels replaceable?
Well, that's a great question as well, and that's going to be something that will be specific to the solar panel manufacturer. But that's something that I'd be happy to try and figure out. But that that requires kind of some prediction abilities that I don't necessarily have at this point in time.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for that, Bob. And I think it sounds like the answer is, to Bob's very, very important question, are they replaceable? I think that the industry will have to try to make them as replaceable as possible going forward to make it as seamless as possible, because otherwise it can be occasionally a hard sell. We've got some great questions coming in online, but our phones are on fire. So let's grab a couple more quick ones here. This is Bill and Victor. Bill, thanks for calling Connections.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I can actually answer Bob's questions. My wife and I live in Victor. We just contracted to have solar panels put on the roof of our barn. They're warranted for 25 years. If any panel falls below, I think, 88% of its original generating capacity, it will be replaced. They're easily replaced. The system on paper costs $32,000, but by the time you get your rebates and your tax credits, it actually will cost us a little over $9,000. In 8.5 years, it will have paid for it for itself, and for the following however many years, that is 17 years of its warranty, we will not be paying for electricity, and RG&E will be obliged to take any excess, give us credit for any excess electricity that we generate. So as far as I'm concerned, as an investment, it's a pretty good deal, and there's reputable companies in the area that have a long history of doing this. They know what they're talking about. And the other thing I'd like to say about the issue in general is that the rich and powerful on the eve of World War I were willing to sacrifice their children on the altar of honor. And right now, the rich and powerful are willing to sacrifice not just their children, but future generations on the altar of money. And I think that's kind of the bottom line of the whole situation now.
Well, Bill, thanks for the call, and thanks for the background on the cost especially. Again, he said $32,000, but after rebates and tax credits, about $9,000, and an estimated to have paid for itself in about 8 to 9 years. Susan, does that square with a lot of what you've seen?
Yeah, that's about average. And, of course, the cost is going to be slightly different depending on the size of the installation that you're looking at. But Bill's experience is pretty standard, and I'm really glad for him to call in and talk about how well it went for him and how exciting it is to think about 17 years of not having to pay for energy and, in fact, making money off the energy that you're producing.
You can join the conversation with me on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. Marco says, silly question, but any way to make solar panels or cells more attractive looking might make American consumers more likely to buy them.
That's a great point, Marco. So if I can plug my own research for a minute, that's kind of one of the unexpected results of the materials that I work with. So there's a lot of people developing new technologies called organic solar cells. And the reason why they're unique is that they're flexible, they're transparent, and we can make them in a wide variety of pretty colors. So we can go from blues and greens and purples to kind of pink and reddish hues. So now that we've figured out how to make them work well and how to get them onto people's houses, I think aesthetic improvement is definitely one of the next steps.
So not a silly question at all,
no,
Marco.
No.
Jake asks on Twitter, isn't manufacturing solar cells in the U.S. problematic because of China subsidizing and dumping on the U.S. market?
Yes, is the short answer to that question, and that's why we need to have more proactive policies that promote U.S. manufacturing of these solar cells specifically.
Back to the phones. This is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Susan.
Hello.
You know, I'm a big proponent of geothermal, solar, wind. Not so much ethanol. I think you kind of brought that up a little bit. But one of my concerns, though, is the EPA and the administration is really putting pressure on prices both of coal plants, nuclear, and even oil or gas-fired producers. And that, to me, shouldn't be done. I think we should produce as much fossil fuel that we can within reason. The coal-burning facilities, for instance, have been cleaned to a great extent as far as the byproduct. And I think this carbon, the carbon credits, and the harm of carbon dioxide is way overblown. In fact, carbon dioxide is part of photosynthesis, and I think this whole thing is way exaggerated. I do applaud, the four sources that I mentioned earlier, but I just think we're jumping the gun way too quick. In fact, I heard that Germany actually has cut back on their alternative energy and going more to fossil fuels because of inefficiencies. And also, I saw a projection of GDP is projected to go down substantially over the next 20 to 25 years due to the alternative energies and getting away from fossil fuels. What are your thoughts?
So, first of all, John, thanks for all of the thoughts there. A lot to chew on. Susan, you want to work back? Let's kind of work backwards. Let's start with the GDP question. His concern is GDP is going down if we go to alternative energies. You at least agree that we've got to find a way to scalable so the economy isn't wrecked when we move over away from carbon.
I agree completely. And I think that one of the common misconceptions about alternative energy is that it's being promoted by a bunch of environmentalists who don't really care about jobs. I mean, I'm from Rochester. My entire family worked at Kodak. I believe firmly in the middle class and in manufacturing jobs. So I think that the jobs that would be lost in the fossil fuel industry can be gained 5 to 10-fold in the alternative energy industry. So I believe that there are jobs there. And not only are there jobs there, there's an opportunity for consumers to spend money. So this is, I believe that this is something that will grow the economy.
He also talked about Germany. His understanding is Germany is moving back to fossil fuels. Are you hearing that?
No, Germany is fairly consistent with the way that they're doing things. They don't have a lot of political instability that would indicate that type of change, like what is happening in Australia. Germany is very committed to continuing with their renewable energy structure, and I believe they're trying to get to 75% from renewables by 2050. So.
John's a regular listener and caller as well. I know he has expressed concern in the past that some of the concerns about climate change are being hyperbolized to the point where it's not moving as rapidly as we think, or some of the causes aren't quite as well-founded as we're being told. What do you say to that?
Well, I would rely on the science, and I would rely on the facts when we look at trends over long periods of time. So John brought up a great point. So CO2 is used in photosynthesis. We want plants. We want trees. So we want humans to be able to exhale. So why is this a bad thing? Well, the problem is when we put in too much CO2, this system and the systems on the planet are not going to be able to function. So we're essentially putting 400,000 Hiroshima bombs of energy into the atmosphere every day of the year. So we are contributing an enormous amount of energy that the system is not built to handle. So while CO2 is a natural part of existence, the amount at which it is present is not natural. And these emissions are very easy to measure, and they're measured across the board by a variety of sources in a variety of countries. And there's really no dispute on how much CO2 we're emitting. And there also is not a dispute on the impact that is having on global temperatures.
Let's get back to the phones. This is Becky in Las Vegas. Becky, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have a really quick question for Susan. Wondering how far you would be willing to travel to be a climate communicator, because I can think of a number of teachers, including myself in Las Vegas, that would love to have you come and talk to our middle school and high school students. I'm happy to take my answers off.
Well, hold on, Becky. Let me at least ask you briefly. Are you listening online? It's nice to have a call from Las Vegas.
Yes, we are.
Do you have ties to the area here?
Yeah, actually, my husband and I both grew up in Rochester, lived in Rochester and around the area for many, many years, moved off to Las Vegas to teach because I couldn't find a teaching job in Rochester.
I see. Well, thank you for staying with the program, and it's great to hear from you. So, Susan, and thanks, Becky, for the call. Go ahead, Susan. What do you think?
Thanks for the call, Becky. I really appreciate that. I personally, I'll do everything that I possibly can to spread the message, but there are now 6,000 climate reality leaders worldwide, like myself, who have been trained by Mr. Gore. So I would be more than happy to direct one to you in your area in Las Vegas. You can also find them online through the Climate Reality Project. And they would love to come and speak to your high school, middle school. Anybody that wants to learn, we're happy to come out.
You might regret this, but if Becky wants to get in touch with you, can she do that?
Yes, she can. I can give my email address. Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's SX as in xylophone, S, 7565@rit.edu.
And Becky, if you missed that, it'll be on the podcast, which we'll have online later today. We are very late for taking the shortest break in radio, and we're going to come back with more with Susan Spencer, who is talking about the future of solar technology, some of the research that she is involved with that might, it almost certainly is going to bring more solar technology to Rochester. The question is how much and when. We're taking a look at our alternative energy future today on Connections. Stay with us. Coming up in our second hour, prayer at town meetings. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the town of Greece this past spring, and now the town is welcoming an atheist to lead the invocation. What will he say? We're going to find out when Dan Courtney joins us in studio. Is this evidence of healing, or will it spark more division? That's coming up next hour on Connections with Evan Dawson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Writer Paul Theroux has traveled the world, and his latest journey takes him through the past, present, and future of the most impoverished corners of the American South.
It is an overlooked America, but I think it's an undervalued America.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 2.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we get back to the phones, Susan Spencer, a question for you.
Sure.
25 years into the future in Rochester, give me a picture of energy, the way you expect to see it, whether you're driving through a neighborhood or downtown, and the way people are accessing energy. What's it going to look like in 25 years?
I would like to see us completely switch to renewable energy technologies here. So solar for every roof and business, and this would have an enormous impact on people's ability to be able to spend money and be able to do things. So I would imagine that we would have an incredibly vibrant economy with lots of jobs and lots of available capital for investments. This type of technology is, again, it's very clean. We have a wonderful river that we can also, you know, get hydroelectric power from and tap into the wind energy that is in the surrounding areas. So I would love to see Rochester rejuvenate its status as a manufacturing city. But instead of manufacturing kind of things of the past, we would be manufacturing the technologies of the future here. So roll-to-roll processed solar cells, all kinds of new materials and new applications of this technology for personal consumer use. So that's my vision of Rochester's future.
That's what you'd like to see. Do you expect it?
I have all the best hopes in the world, but I do recognize the hard realities, which is that in order for something like this to happen, there needs to be policy support. So we're still on our way to that. So Rochester is part of the Clean Communities under the National Clean Cities Program. So there are already investments and ideas happening in this city that want to transition us. But that being said, it won't be an easy road. It will be an uphill battle to get the transition started. I feel very reassured when I hear callers talking about their acceptance of these technologies and even their utilization of them. So,
in 25 years, you say we're going to see solar cells on most rooftops. Will we still see gas stations all over the place?
Well, the alternative transportation sector is not my personal area of expertise. I would say that we have a very reduced amount of gas stations. I think that there still will be some. So my grandfather, who is probably listening, will want to be able to gas up his V8s. And there's, you know, there is a use and a place for fossil fuels, but that has to be minimized. It really has to be made smaller. So the shift over to hybrid and electric vehicles, I think, is inevitable as people realize how efficient and how much cheaper they end up being.
And before I grab another phone call, let me at least play devil's advocate and ask you about, you say you need policy support to make sure we start shifting toward alternative energy, especially solar, et cetera, more policy support. there is an argument that says in a free market, you don't need policy support. You need evidence that something is scalable and will make money. And as long as that's true, companies will happily shift if they see there is a market for it.
So here's the thing. I agree with that completely. The trends that are occurring are very good for solar. And what you can compare are countries where policies are in place to support renewable energy development and where policies are not. So here in the U.S., I think we're at about 12% of renewable energy use. Germany's 31%. China is now banning coal-fired power plants. Their president is extremely on board with green and renewable energies. And by implementing policies that promote this, China has now catapulted to the number one photovoltaic producer in the world. So that's what policy can do. Look, the technology's here. People are getting it. It's going to be used, and it's going to be used at a greater and greater rate each year. But if we want to escalate that, if we want to be competing on the global free market, then we need to have policies in place that support that.
Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, hi. I totally agree with what everything your guest is saying in terms of the importance of alternative energy and what you just finished saying. One thing I would love to see is that Rochester has an old housing stock. It has many people that are low income. And the current alternatives for them are very limited. Even when they try to get assistance for a new furnace or whatever, there are not options of solar panels that they can choose from. I realize that's partly because of the cost, but it would be great, and it would be actually a big, big policy issue if those doors were open more to include people who probably need more financial assistance to be able to have a choice of solar panels in this city, including poorer areas. That would probably, once people get used to the idea and are more continue to be educated, that would probably go over quite large. And I think that would be increasing numbers of people using it as well.
Thanks, Bonnie. What do you think, Susan?
I completely agree with Bonnie's point. And again, I'd like to point out that the costs of solar are coming down, and they're going to start coming down even more. So the option for someone who is at the poverty line, below the poverty line, while there's not an enormous amount of options right now, I truly believe that there will be within the next 6 years.
Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I'm still remembering BP and the blowout in the Gulf and what that cost us. It's as though whatever benefits accrued to a small number of people, the cost just so far outweighed it and what we've lost. And I'm just not personally, I don't think that's something to take risk with. As I've said before, I've heard that we have dead zones in the Gulf, and that's what I feel about fracking. Once our precious environment is destroyed, it's the genie's out of the bottle. It's irreversible damage. We have really lost something and forever, and for what? Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Jane, at a personal level, I agree with you completely. I care very much about the environment and about protecting it, and it was actually why I got into the PhD program that I did in the first place. So I agree with your point 100%, and renewable energies would have a huge impact in preserving and protecting what remains of our environment.
How much, when you do research in solar, and you've got your head down working so hard on sort of one part of the energy future, although it may be the biggest and most important, how much do you try to stay aware of algae, cellulosic ethanol, other ideas that haven't quite been scaled yet but are out there?
Well, as a PhD student, I have to stay abreast of a lot of technologies for my specific field. So the technologies that you mentioned don't actually fall into the ones that I typically stay up on. But as a climate reality leader, I think it's very important for me to be, at a functioning level on most of these new technologies. So I try to stay up to speed as much as I possibly can.
Is there anything that you're reading out there that excites you anywhere near the level of solar?
Well, I think there's lots of really cool technologies that are starting to emerge that involve you know, manipulation of biological systems for a variety of applications, not just solar. So using bacteria to print and pattern solar cells or circuit boards. I really like anything that is directly mimicking Mother Nature, because most of the time she's doing it at a much greater efficiency than humans have managed. So that's the kind of stuff that I get excited about.
And if you're just joining us, Susan Spencer was in Australia, in Melbourne, about a month ago now, for 5 days as part of a 500-person conference keynoted by Al Gore. It was his foundation that put on the event, in which they learned about the cost of carbon, among other things. So what are some of the things we haven't gotten to in this hour that came out of that conference that you're taking with you, Susan?
I think there's kind of four main points, and those are the global warming is real, and that it is being caused by CO2 emissions from man-made activities, that these are causing irreversible damage to our environment, and that we need to immediately make changes that will allow us to thrive, not just survive as a species.
When we first talked about you coming on the program, you indicated that you didn't want to spend too much of the hour sort of lassoing the issue of, is climate change happening or not? And I said, don't worry, that's not what I want to waste time with either. Mm-hmm. Because let's sort of be honest here. I would love it if it were not, and wouldn't you?
It would be great if it wasn't actually a problem, but it is.
Right, and so I'm almost surprised to hear that you go to a Gore Foundation event and they still have to wrangle with the factual basis of that it's happening.
Well, it's really an interesting phenomenon. So studies that have been done, extensive studies in the U.S. and Australia, show that in both of those countries, about 8% of people are very hardcore deniers of global warming. So these are people whose minds cannot, will not be changed about it. But if you ask that same statistical sample set, how many people believe that the number of people who don't believe in global warming, the average respondent will tell you 20 to 30%. So even though there's a small number of people that are denying it, they're having an impact on the larger conversation. So that was one of the key pieces of the training.
But I look at it the other way. If 30% or 40%, whatever the number is, mm-hmm. pick a country or, you know, pick a survey, whatever the number of people, let's just say for argument's sake, 40% of Americans don't think the climate is changing or that human beings are causing that change. But 8% have their minds made up so irrevocably that you'll never, evidence would not move them. That indicates that there is room for movement with evidence. And I say all the time, I'm open to the notion that we're not changing the climate. I need to see evidence.
Yes.
And I've been looking at evidence, and I also trust scientists. So I'm absolutely open to it.
There's a scientist who's just put out a $30,000 reward for someone to prove, using the scientific method, that climate change is not happening. So there's $30,000 out there for anybody who is able to do that. But so if you look at peer-reviewed papers in 2013, 9,136 authors agree that climate change is real, it's caused by global warming, and global warming is being caused by the activities of man. One person is on the fence.
Yeah, let's not waste any more time on this. We've got about 90 seconds left with Susan. So what's next for you? You come back from this conference now. A lot's changed for you in the last couple of months. And again, working on your PhD in microsystems engineering, what's mm-hmm. next for you?
Well, I am defending my PhD at the end of August, and I will then be hopefully transitioning to a job. So I am currently looking for postdoc opportunities both here and in the United States and overseas. But I will be continuing to talk about climate change and about the impacts of it wherever I am, wherever I go.
So. Is there a market for the work that you could do in Rochester?
I believe that there is a market for it. It's making sure that I find that market and they are able to hire me on board. So, you know, there's a huge development right now, actually in a lot of Kodak's old buildings, developing new solar cell technologies. So there's a lot of stuff that's coming online that's really exciting. And ideally, I would love to stay in Rochester. This is my hometown.
And when the whole corn-based ethanol thing was happening, it was interesting. You'd see certain parts of the country more on board with it than others. When it comes to solar, And again, that's not a fair comparison because solar is not corn-based ethanol. That's apples and hammers we're comparing. But solar, where in this country is it really sort of ahead of the curve when it comes to solar?
You know, the funny thing is it's not necessarily where you get the sunniest days. So RIT has a really great research facility. Corning has a great research facility. You have amazing technologies, of course, out in the Southwest. In Colorado, we have the National Renewable Energy Lab. So there, it's kind of all over the United States. You really can't go wrong.
Thank you for taking the time and sharing an hour with us and answering a lot of questions either online, Twitter, and by phone. Great questions from a lot of people. And what it tells me is there's a lot of interest and movement on this already, don't you think?
I agree. Thanks so much for having me.
Susan Spencer, our guest for the hour. Short break, and we're coming back with the man who is giving the invocation tonight at the Greasetown board meeting. He will be the first atheist to give an invocation there. He's in studio with us next.